Heroic women, tragic stories, and lessons for today.
They made a huge sacrifice. A huge sacrifice. Their lives were never the same.
History knows them as the Angels of Bataan, but they can help us understand today's returning vets. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. When Pearl Harbor was attacked in World War II, a group of nurses who never expected to be on the front lines found themselves in a combat zone and taken prisoner. They faced impossible working conditions, constant fear, and starvation. The experience would haunt them the rest of their lives and helps us better understand the issues faced by today's returning veterans. Mary Cronk Farrell is the author of Pure Grit, How World War II Nurses in the Pacific Survived Combat and Prison Camp. First of all, Mary, what drew you to this subject? What brought you to this book?
Well, it was an accident, really. It's not like I went looking for it. I've always been interested in history, and I was just amazed that I had never heard that the Japanese had captured women. And then as soon as I got into reading about them and doing the research, I became more and more inspired by them. And the day I first read about them, I was like, I have to write this book.
So for people who don't know this story, can you briefly explain who these women were and what happened?
The basic story is that just 9 hours after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, they also bombed American bases and forts in the Philippine Islands. And the nurses were there. There was a naval hospital there. There was a pretty large army hospital in Manila. There were several smaller hospitals on different military installations there, and there were 101 nurses there when the Japanese attacked.
The way you describe it, it sounded like it was supposed to be a fun job. It was doing your work in a beautiful tropical location.
That's right. It was like a tropical vacation with a little bit of nursing duty thrown in. The attacks were devastating. The U.S. Air Force in the Far East was practically decimated. The naval base was completely destroyed. And so immediately the United States forces there began retreating. And General MacArthur declared Manila an open city in hopes that it would not be destroyed and civilians wouldn't be killed. So the army just picked up and left. And they retreated to the Bataan Peninsula, where they wanted to make a stand, and the nurses went with them. The army nurses went with them. Navy nurses stayed in Manila and were captured right away when the Japanese came and took Manila. And the battle for the Bataan Peninsula went on for 4 months, and the nurses worked in the hospitals, field hospitals on Bataan all that time, often working 20-hour shifts in surgery that was overwhelmed with wounded and just going on through the night. The Navy nurses that were captured remained taking care of their patients, and then the Japanese moved the Navy nurses to a civilian internment camp, Santo Tomas internment camp. Initially, the problems were crowded conditions. Eventually, they started running out of food, but that wasn't for a couple, a year and a half or two before the food started getting scarce.
And you did get the opportunity to speak with one of those women.
That's right. Army nurse Millie Dalton Manning was the one remaining nurse when I started doing my research. In fact, when I first started, people that I talked to said, oh, no, they've all died. But then eventually I found this I found out that this one was still alive, and I was able to meet with her and talk with her. She died March 8th last year.
Was there ever any official recognition or honors for these women?
Male officers who knew what they had done nominated them for medals that are given for combat service, because women weren't supposed to be in combat. They weren't given those medals until the medal was posthumously awarded to Army Commander Maude Davison. Other than that, they had some immediate celebrity, some of them, and then they were told to forget about what had happened, move on with their lives, don't talk about it, and were not recognized for their service and sacrifice until the early 1980s, when there was a POW recognition day in Washington, D.C. at the White House, and I think maybe about 30 of them were still alive and well enough to travel for that, and they were honored then.
Nowadays, we are so much more aware of the long-term impacts, the trauma of being in combat or being a prisoner. And I wondered if you had found that most of these women managed to live happy, healthy lives, or were some of them really impacted by what had happened to them for the rest of their lives?
They were all impacted forever, as far as what I read. And the family members that I talked to, they went on to, some of them went on to have prestigious careers in the military. Some of them went on to have children and raise families. But they suffered until the end. In fact, a number of them, things worsened near the end. A couple of them, I heard, when they were elderly and started having nightmares and flashbacks, much worse so than they had earlier in their lives.
So, Mary, you've really immersed yourself in the story of these women, and I wondered, after everything that you learned and after writing about them and really learning their stories, was this story equal parts heroism and tragedy?
That's a hard question. I ask myself that a lot. The ones that I was able to find out more about in their later lives, talk to people who had known them, they all went on to continue to be caring individuals. They had families, but they did suffer. They made a huge sacrifice. Their lives were never the same. Many of them suffered health problems their entire lives. But in a way, they're no different than people coming home from war today. You have to wonder, even people who volunteer and sign up and join the military today, young people, if they really know what they're getting into either. I don't know if until you're actually there in the battle, you can have any idea what you're getting into. One of the hopes that I have, I mean, I think these women deserve our memory and our honor and gratefulness, respect, all of that. They're heroines for sure. But I don't want the book to end there. I put 5 years of my life into this, and there were days when I broke down into tears crying at my computer. because of the horrors of this story. And my hope is that it will move people to better understanding of the issues that veterans face, better understanding of how war impacts us and our communities, and the price that is paid by these individuals is incalculable.
Mary Cronk Farrell is the author of Pure Grit, How World War II Nurses in the Pacific Survived Combat and Prison Camp. Animal research is now showing that witnessing just one traumatic event can permanently change the brain. Imagine what the ongoing civil war in Syria is doing to children who not only see friends and family killed, but are victimized or recruited to fight. UN Radio's Patrick Megwa reports that global children's advocate organizations are worried about an entire generation of Syrian children.
As the Syrian war enters its fourth consecutive year, over 5.5 million Syrian children face a bleak future, according to United Nations agencies and their partners working in the country. United Nations Children's Fund UNICEF and the UN Refugee Agency UNHCR say the civil war in Syria continues to expose children to relentless horror and suffering, adding that with no end in sight, an entire generation of Syrian children could be robbed of their future. The agencies, together with their partners Mercy Corps, Save the Children Fund and World Vision, have issued a call for action urging the public to voice their outrage at the devastating impact of the Syrian conflict on children. The call for action is demanding an immediate end to the violence against children and more investment in the education and psychological protection of all children affected by the conflict. Melissa Fleming is UNHCR spokesperson in Geneva.
There are more than 5 million children who are affected by the violence, the trauma, the displacement of this conflict. We are demanding an end to the violence, particularly against children. It would be great if the war could just stop tomorrow, but all those in the fighting must fully respect humanitarian law, end recruitment of children, and commit to a peaceful resolution overall. There should be an end to the blockade of humanitarian assistance. Also, attacks on humanitarian workers and facilities as we're carrying out these life-saving deliveries, these must stop. Finally, the children, they should be in school. They should not have to witness violence. The refugee population of children should not have to work to get money for their families.
The UN Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution demanding that all parties to the Syrian conflict allow delivery of humanitarian assistance, cease depriving civilians of food and medicine, and enable the rapid, safe, and unhindered evacuation of all civilians who wished to leave. Patrick Maigua, United Nations, Geneva.
Coming up, more conversations about war and its aftermath. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1286. Nathan and Leslie Keith met on a military base in Kuwait in 2006. They're both Navy veterans, and together they served for a cumulative 27 years. They present a happy, well-adjusted front to the world, but they're carrying emotional scars from their time serving in the Middle East. Judy Silber reports.
In many ways, Nathan and Leslie Keith are well-adjusted, regular people.
My name is Leslie Keith. I was in the Navy from April 1999 to April 2010, total of 11 years.
My name is Nathan Keith. I joined the Navy in 1996, February, and I got out approximately 16 years later.
They're both in their early 40s, friendly, and they obviously care a lot about one another. Nathan Keith speaks with pride about the day he met Leslie on a military base in Kuwait. They're now married, and they both study and work at the same time. On the surface, they lead stable lives. But dig a little deeper, and you'll find that the Keiths are in the middle of a serious struggle. It started in 2006, just after they came back from Kuwait.
I think that we both came back a little not as patient with other people. And because we came from such a traumatic place, from such a tense environment.
Neither Leslie nor Nathan saw combat. But in Kuwait, they felt what was happening in Iraq. Leslie screened soldiers for PTSD and plucked shrapnel from the wounded. Her husband worked as a customs and border patrol guard, and some of the convoy drivers he befriended disappeared. Initially, to cope, they drank a lot. Like on a week-long cruise they took a few months after they got back.
We went on this cruise and we ended up spending, what was it, almost $2,000?
Yeah.
Just in alcohol.
I think that we were both stressed out. I don't know if you'd call it PTSD per se, but we just drank for that comfort and to help us calm down, because you are so hypervigilant when you come back to the States and it takes a long time to just really settle down and just be able to relax.
Right now, the Keiths are not officially diagnosed with PTSD, but they both suffer from anxiety, and Leslie came back sick from Kuwait. She couldn't sleep well or remember simple things, like whether she'd eaten or taken a shower. Eventually, she was diagnosed with a parathyroid disorder, possibly caused by her time overseas. The Keiths left the Navy in 2010. That was especially tough on Nathan. They both found help at the VA, but still felt isolated and depressed. Then a VA counselor suggested they try something different, a Zen meditation retreat, just for veterans.
We always honor everybody's bravery when you come for the first time to some event, when you have no idea what you're walking into, and now you come.
Inside a large yurt, a meditation teacher speaks to a group of 25 veterans, including the Keiths. They're at Green Gulch Farm, a retreat center in Marin, right off Highway 1. It's quiet here, peaceful. Leslie is excited for the one-day workshop. Nathan, not so much.
That's just me nowadays. I was looking for literally any reason to not go. And then when we got up, I was just like, okay, fine, I'll go. I'll go.
So we're just going to start off with introductions.
The teacher is Lee Lesser, and she's the executive director of Honoring the Path of the Warrior, or HPW. It's the nonprofit that organized this gathering.
Where you served, when you served.
Hi, my name is Matt Cruz. I served from 97 to 2003 in the Army. I was infantry.
Hey everybody, I'm Sam. I was in the Army. I did 7 years. I was a mechanic and a combat medic. I was medevaced out of Iraq. Ended up in Germany.
My name is Jesse. I was an Army military police slash medic. And I served from 2002 to 2008. I went to 2 tours in Iraq. My second tour, I received a traumatic brain injury, which in turn made me have a stroke. I cannot use my left
side. Some of the vets have been coming to HPW for years. Others, like the Keiths, are here for the first time. Despite his initial reluctance, Nathan Keith opened right up.
Morning, everybody. I'm Nathan Keith. I was stationed on the Iraq-Kuwait border as a Navy Customs and Border Patrol agent, as a reservist. I've met a lot of great people. I've lost some really great friends. To have the military say that you're a great person as long as you're deployed, but when you get back to the States, we don't need you. And that's what happened.
It's an intense opening to the day. After introductions, Lee Lesser passes around fist-sized sandbags and tells the veterans to also grab a meditation cushion. When she rings a bell, she tells them to pair up and toss the objects back and forth as fast as they can.
You ever play the game Hot Potato when you were kids? You know, so it's like a hot potato, you don't want to keep it in your hand. And are you holding your breath, or is your breath moving freely?
Lesser isn't a vet herself. She's a longtime student of Zen Buddhism. When the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, she was reminded of the Vietnam War and how hard it was for soldiers when they came home. This time around, she wanted to help.
Somehow it just pulled at me. I wanted to do something. And what I felt like I could offer is the practice of sensory awareness, which is the practice I relied on since I was 19 years old.
Pausing and just noticing what aliveness you feel in your body now.
It's being in your body, being with your breath, being with our natural sensations as an anchor. And I felt that if veterans would be interested, this would be useful.
I'd like you to get just a little bit closer, and this time you're going to exchange with your eyes closed.
At the first event 7 years ago, the focus was more on sitting meditation. But the vets couldn't sit still, so Lesser and her co-founder decided to include moving meditations with activities like hiking, rock climbing, or whitewater rafting, all the while tuning into body and breath. Today at Green Gulch, the group gets quieter as the day passes, as if the vets are becoming more at ease. After lunch, the group walks to a garden. They stop occasionally when a bell rings, just to listen. They then gather around a tree where HPW co-founder Chris Fortin points to chamomile growing in the grass.
You know about chamomile? It's calming.
I would even suggest that you might want to just right now lay down in a patch of chamomile. Let your body, if you want to, feel the support of the earth underneath you and the sweet smell of the chamomile.
Doing things that not only calm the mind but also help calm the body can be really helpful, and so we are seeing a lot more of that.
That's Jeff Stadler. He's a therapist with the VA in Menlo Park. He says mindfulness exercises can be helpful for veterans with PTSD or for those who just come home anxious and hypervigilant. The VA itself is starting to use similar practices.
I suspect that in the future that we're going to be seeing a lot more of it, and it's going to become maybe a much more integrated part and more readily offered type of approach than it is right now.
But Stadler says HPW's approach is unique in that it combines meditation with community and nature.
They create a very safe environment, and they make it one in which people feel comfortable to be open with others and to be able to express some of the things that are challenges for them.
I do that when I'm like...
So what's always grounded me in life is the thought of infinity.
Back in the yurt, it's towards the end of the day, and Lee Lesser asks the veterans to draw something that gives them strength. Nathan Keith draws an infinity symbol.
We could go anywhere and do anything, but we forget that. Whitewater rafting, going into the military, becoming an Eagle Scout, coming to this thing today, you can do this.
Leslie Keith is also feeling more hopeful after the retreat.
I felt like I was understood. I felt like somebody had empathy for me. That's what I really appreciated, and that's what I've always wanted. I just want people to have empathy for me.
A few weeks later, the Keiths are thinking about the kinds of changes they want to make in their lives. At this point, it's nothing too ambitious. Clean the house, get out into nature, go for walks. They also want to attend another HPW event. This time, Nathan says he won't resist. For Cross Currents, I'm Judy Silber.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.